This week on Thinking Biblically, we complete a very special journey through the book of Job. Welcome to Thinking Biblically. My name is Alan Gilman. Thinking Biblically is a podcast dedicated to exploring how all of Scripture speaks to all of life. Before I introduce my guest, I want to remind everyone, if you haven't done so already, to please subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, don't forget to like and to share. All that really, really helps. If you want to contact me at any time, you can do so at comments@thinkingbiblically.org. 2.5 years ago, December 2022, I had the delightful privilege to interview Ellie Wiener as she had recently embarked on her academic journey of pursuing a PhD at the University of Cambridge in England. Ellie was heartily recommended as a guest on my podcast by my son Daniel, also a Cambridge PhD candidate. What intrigued me before I met her was that her dissertation topic was on the book of Job, which I'll let her explain in a moment. During that podcast, I suggested the possibility of checking in with her about midway through her studies, which we did at the end of April 2024, and again when she was done, which brings us to today. So if you've not yet seen or heard the first two segments, I highly recommend you do so. I provide the links to those episodes in the description. Ellie grew up in the Chicago area. She graduated from Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in May 2002 with an MA in Biblical Languages and an MA in Old Testament. As she wraps up her time in Cambridge, she's preparing for a host of new endeavors, including returning to the U.S., marriage, and taking up her new role of adjunct Old Testament professor at four different institutions, including teaching Exploring the Old Testament for her former alma mater, Gordon Conwell, in the fall, and she'll be teaching biblical wisdom literature for Luke Divinity School in the spring. Ellie Wiener, welcome back to Thinking Biblically.
Thank you so much, Alan, for having me back. I must not have scared you off too badly in the first two. I'm glad we've been able to bring it to closure.
Those were both delightful times. I'm not anticipating anything less this time around. In fact, you're surrounded by a miracle. You're still in England. Folks, that's not a fake background. That's the real thing. The sun is shining in Cambridge today.
It sure is. You know, actually, I've learned that Cambridge is one of the driest places in England. So we actually get quite a lot of sunshine. It's quite delightful. Lot. And this place knows how to do gardens.
Do you remember what quite a lot of sunshine means?
Well, that's true. Relative terms.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, it's the sun's been poking through. We were talking earlier. We'll see what that's going to do. But it is making Ellie look quite angelic today. And there's probably more than one reason to that. As I mentioned, she is going to get married soon. I don't know if you want to talk about that at all. You want to tell everybody where the wedding is so they can join you?
Yes. Everyone, welcome to Charlotte, North Carolina. Yeah, so in about a month and a half, Isaac, my fiance, and I will be married, Lord willing. And I always say, want to caveat with, unless Jesus returns in the meantime, which I would welcome. But I'm looking forward to marrying Isaac. So Isaac is, currently in Charlotte. So I'll be joining him there. And yeah, very thankful. We met years ago at Gordon Conwell. And then remained friends for a couple of years. And and then obviously at some stage started dating and here we are. So.
Yeah, so we did, the plan was to meet those two extra times looking forward to when the dissertation would be complete. Do you want to tell the folks how complete it is?
Oh, yes. I've crossed the defense milestone. So, sometimes called a viva, if you want to be a Latinist about it. But you submit your dissertation, and then several weeks to several months elapse. And then at Cambridge, you have two examiners, one internal to the university, one external to the university, who read your work and then grill you for several hours. And so last week is when I had my defense. And thanks be to God, I've passed, I'm through. And so, there's still several more formalizing stages, but it should be as good as wrapped up. It's just the formalities now to finish. So
congratulations would be in order.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So oh, yeah, very it's grateful. Pretty amazing. And as I said, when we first started, Job of all things. I know there will be people that are watching this that have already seen the first two segments, but why don't we start by doing an overview of what your dissertation now was all about. I'll just jump in while I'm thinking of it. Are you going to turn it into a book that people could buy? Is that in your list of to-dos?
It is. Now, of course, it's not a unilateral decision, so I definitely need a publisher to be convinced. But in my ideal world, I would love to, in a relatively unchanged fashion, publish my dissertation as an academic monograph. But then I'd really love to write a second, more popular level book. So still very robust exegetically, but just not assuming people know Hebrew and taking out some of the academic jargon. So it's just a bit more accessible for someone who's not a professional biblical scholar. So I would ideally love to do both of those things down the line. So in a nutshell, my research question was, does the book of Job resolve? And if so, how? So essentially starting from
observation. For our non-technical folks, what do you mean by does the book of Job resolve?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I was speaking of resolution in basically the normal literary sense of, does the plot come to closure? And for Job, that's a particularly puzzling question because you have so many different literary segments within the book and so many competing voices that to fit the book together and therefore come to some conclusion about what its main message is and purpose is, can feel like quite a steep task. And it's given rise to a plethora of suggestions about either Job's irresolution, reasons why it doesn't resolve or can't resolve within scholarship, or some suggestions for its resolution that I don't find particularly helpful. So essentially, I was trying to enter into that literary theological conversation about how the book of Job works as a whole, what it's attempting to communicate. I suppose both point out some things that I think are less helpful in the way that conversation has already been playing out in scholarship, and then propose what I hope are some helpful ways forward. Not to say that I'm the only one ever to sort out the book of Job. I would never presume to do such a thing, but trying to make a contribution in that area.
So does it resolve?
Or do you say that right? Yes.
You think it does. You don't have to give it all away, especially if you're going to be publishing the book on it. But still, we have been talking about it. I know the unique thing that you are bringing to your work that you've already shared. And I don't know if that's changed at all. But in terms of what the book of Job is all about, do you want to share that with folks again? Get on the same page here.
Yeah. So in essence, I speak of the resolution of Job as being relational. So it does come as something of you could call it a plot curveball in that, well, in a sense, it's surprising. In a sense, it's not. When I say curveball, I suppose the resolution of Job is surprising in that Job and his companions, both the friends and then later Elihu, are really fixated on the why question. They think, and Job thinks, he needs an explanation for what has happened to him. And you as the reader have been made sympathetic to that line of questioning because you've read the prologue. So you have this information, it's dramatic irony. So you have information that the characters lack and that you've listened into this heavenly dialogue. So you think you know, and you're tracking along with this unwieldy, unfolding dialogue, trying to judge who's more accurate than the other, and are, as I say, sympathetic to this line of questioning, this why question. And then when God answers from the whirlwind, it turns out he's not interested at all in answering the why question. In fact, he challenges the premise that Job could even drag him to court in the first place to demand an explanation. And God, as I see it, essentially offers who rather than why, offers himself to Job. And that's, as I say, in one sense, surprising because God changes the question and therefore gives a different answer. And yet, on another hand, it's not surprising because all along...
What do you mean God changes the question? I think you said it. Make it clear again.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. It changes it from being an issue of why Job is suffering to who. Who is God to me in my suffering? What Job actually needs to know is God for me or is God against me? Has God abandoned me? Will God answer me? Will God listen to my voice? And he'll say in chapter 42, verse 5, I'd heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye has seen you. There's been this immediacy of encounter with God.
Is that the result? I take it.
Well, it is part of it. The resolution, when I call it relational, that works both vertically and horizontally. So vertically in the divine human relationship, and so this encounter with God, and I wouldn't say it's just the encounter, it is also what God says. So we do need, one would also need to talk about the content of the divine whirlwind speeches, as well as the fact that God answers. I think the fact and the how God answers are both important. But yes, that's significant for the vertical, the divine human relational restoration, which just to pick up on something I alluded to earlier is surprising in a sense because God's changing the question, but not surprising in that Job all along has been yearning to hear from God. And the whole literary inertia of the book has been driving us toward this moment of God's appearing. So we desperately need, and we're ardently longing for the re-entry of God's voice by the time chapter 38 rolls around. But then we also need to pay attention to the epilogue of Job, which is typically regarded the epilogue as Job 42, 7 to 17. So it's when you return to prose after all this poetry. And there is where we see this incorporation of the horizontal relational plane, as it were. So Job and his friends have bitterly verbally dueled throughout the book. And it turns out that God has this, this somewhat jarring verdict, having just rebuked Job out of the whirlwind. Now Job turns and rebukes the friends and commends Job vis-a-vis the friends for how, as I take it, it's that Job spoke to God, whereas the friends only spoke to Job about God, never to God about Job. So there's this a failure of intercession. And then God invokes Job as an intercessor to pray for these conspicuously non-interceding friends. Anyway, and so in that act of intercession, you have this kind of cinching together of the vertical and the horizontal relational planes. And so now Job is no longer alienated from God nor from his human community. And then his family comes pouring into his house, and everything about Job's ending state is more than is elevated from where he started. Anyway, there's obviously, in all of those fronts, much more that can be said. However, that's the sort of grand sweep of the direction I've gone for my argument.
Okay, so I remember right from the beginning, you went into your course of study with this understanding that the big issue of Job was the difference between talking, you say it better, talking to Job, can you say it again, as opposed to that?
Yes. So Job is commended for speaking to God. His direction of address has been fundamentally right because it's indicative of his whole life orientation towards God. He speaks to God. Whereas the friends, God burns with anger towards them because, as I take it, you have not spoken to me readily or reliably as my servant Job.
Right, they were talking to Job about God.
About God, not to God.
As opposed to talking
about Job.
Right. So were there any twists and turns as you delved into your studies? Sounds like your basic assumptions, your thesis has held up. But was there anything along the way that, let's put it this way, anything that upset you and really threw you for a loop?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Easy peasy, just smooth sailing, 3 years, study, read, type.
No wrestling with Job. No, this has been very much marked by wrestling. I think, I had this sort of kernel of an idea that was spinning off from that alternate translation of Job 42, 7 and 8 from the time I began. However, what exactly the implications of that insight would be for the reading of the whole book? I mean, there were still so many questions for me about how the book of Job is constructed. So I spent a lot of time wrestling with the function of the prologue. What does it do to you as the reader to read the prologue as your setup for the rest of the book? How is that deliberately constructed so as to draw you into becoming opinionated and even making you feel like you're in position to start judging and evaluating God, because you have this omniscient third-party vantage point, and God is in some sense a character, and it's deliberately unfair, so many aspects of the prologue. And so what is that doing to you as the reader? And then how is it that, yeah, where are you actually meant to land at the end? Because the end is in some ways, even though I do think it resolves, it still presses you into what I call a crisis of decision, which can feel really uncomfortable because you as a reader still have some of these lingering knowledge gaps at the end. There's still questions that you don't have answered. Like, why doesn't God tell Job about the prologue at the end? Didn't he need that? And because we have that information from the beginning of the book, it makes us, I think that actually increases our sense of tension upon encountering the rest of the book. These are some of the things that I really continued to wrestle with, as well as what are the divine whirlwind speeches actually communicating, and what is their tone, their rhetorical tone? Because a lot of people read them and they think, oh, this is sublime, this creation poetry, and I love these, they're so comforting. And then plenty of other readers read the same chapters and think God is just grinding Job into the dust. And some have even come out of the whirlwind speeches and referred to God as, yeah, a big divine bully. And so how do you navigate all of these different perspectives without just saying, yeah, it's kind of a free for all and Job just lets you do whatever you want? So how do you be non-arbitrary in how you try to discern and articulate what the book of Job is doing?
Why don't we take a few minutes to look at some of that, because I could see how easy it would be, especially the way many people read the Bible today, in chunks and isolated portions, this sort of thing. So the God speeches are so wonderful on their own, but then when you realize God's talking to a man who is suffering horrible,
sitting on an ash heap.
Yeah, exactly. With his friends telling him, not only have you done wrong, you should be suffering worse than even what you are suffering. And then God doesn't come and actually comfort him. It's like, good job, Job. You'll keep it up. I'm with you. Like some of the things that we might expect, like there's, it's not pastoral, right? So the thing is, I don't know if you have a pastoral word to say. Are we supposed to go to suffering people and just read those whirlwind speeches? Who do you think you are? You can't make one of those trees behind Ellie right now. Like, that sort of thing. So, in the context, God is talking to Job, and he's basically saying to him, I wanted to say, hey, buddy, you don't know what you're talking about. So maybe the hey, buddy part's not there, because we've got to be careful. And maybe you have some insight on what God's attitude is, right? Because we're not getting that kind of description. We just have the speeches, right? But still, God is putting Job in his place, while he's been suffering so much. So what is God really doing? Do I have to wait for your book?
No, it's fun. We can talk about it. I think there are an array of things that could be said that all contribute to this portrait of what the divine whirlwind speeches are accomplishing rhetorically. And I think you're precisely right that it may sound very elementary, though many people don't read the book of Job in order. And that's quite helpful. It's really going to change how you absorb the whirlwind speeches. So for one, God's speeches are substantive, but they're not soft. And I think one of the things that communicates to us as the reader.
I know it sounds English. I can't even say the word. Like, what does that mean?
Substantive. They have substance, as in it's not God isn't basically God's not being evasive. God isn't just sort of blowing past Job and saying things that are completely irrelevant. But nor is he coddling him. So they're not soft in that it's not, he shows up, oh, let me pat your back, okay, poor buddy.
God's telling it like it is in detail.
Yeah. And he's,
relevant things that Job should understand about stuff.
Yeah. That pertain to his situation. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And they are, and also you realize, oh, God is responsive. He answers, but he's not coercible, meaning you, oh human, don't dictate the terms of this relationship. So God is, or Job is calling to God saying, make known to me, make known to me, make known to me. And what does God do? He shows up and says, who is this who darkens counsel with words without knowledge? I will question you and you make it known to me. So God's going to be the one asking the questions and dictating the terms of the conversation. And consequently, or relatedly, dictating the terms of the divine human relationship. That's in the creator's court.
That doesn't sound seeker sensitive to me.
Well, so I think.
Oh, but it's Old Testament, and God is kind of like that, right? In the Old Testament, it gets really nice later on. Is that right?
I don't think so, Alan, and I don't think you think so either, but I know what you're doing. I think one of the sort of pithy ways that I've tried to sum up part of what the divine whirlwind speeches are doing is to say, actually, it's good news, Job, that God isn't like you. Typically, we think that in order to sort of feel close to God and in order to feel loved by him, it needs to be all of this kind of, God needs to be more like me. But actually, God can still be close, and you can still be in real relationship, though God remains completely other. This is what theologians would often call the transcendence of God. You need to know both that God is transcendent, that he is not like you, and God's immanence, that God is near. And I think we have both of those things in the divine whirlwind speeches. Here is God answering Job. And actually, talk about pastoral. You realize reading the divine whirlwind speeches that God has been listening, because the speeches of God are laced with imagery and wording from earlier in the book. And so I think you get the sense reading that even though Job thought, chapter 9, if I called and he answered me, he wouldn't even be listening to my voice. You realize, oh, God's already been listening from the time God starts speaking. And God is not willing to let Job start from his experiences and then project God's character out from how he's feeling, such that God comes off as capricious, as sort of doing whatever he wants on a whim, and sort of ill-tempered and sort of acting in enmity towards Job. God won't let Job get away with that. So God is going to say, no, let me give you a different accounting of how I relate with my world and of therefore your place within it, my place within it. And that's actually, that realignment is good news. And at the same time, here is God entering into conversation with Job, having listened to his voice. And that's a profoundly dignifying thing. I think Job can be dignified and humbled at the same time.
I want to come back to God's transcendence. Mm-hmm. So that's God is above us. He's separate from us. And you've already talked about some of the intimacy that at the same time God's been listening, right? But I want to try to break a false notion that might be out there. And that is, again, oh, but it's Hebrew Bible, it's Old Testament, it's before Messiah came. And then when Messiah comes, that's when God comes near and he's cuddly, if I may say, not like he is in Job. So I don't think you believe that So in what sense is God today, let me ask it this way, keeping it with the topic at hand, is the God of Job still the God of today, or did God change?
I certainly think it's, I think the God of Job is the God that I pray to, and the God of the New Testament as well.
So God who sometimes talks to us and we might get the impression he's grounding us to dust?
Yeah, I just don't think that we need to say that if creatures are put in their creaturely place, so to speak, if you're made aware that it turns out, I'm not God. Like, that doesn't need to be this sort of debasing thing that leaves me just in a, you know, ashamed heap on the floor. That's actually a really good place for me to be. And God's rebuke doesn't mean God's absence. It's actually a really good thing that God shows up to rebuke Job. The most devastating thing in the book, I think, would be if God never answered. That would be devastating.
Right. Just to kind of sew this up, and we'll come right back to focusing on Job itself. But you think of Messiah comes, the people of Israel, they have an agenda for the Messiah. And while he doesn't completely demolish it, he certainly does a lot of redefining and surprises. Yes. That's on the bigger scale. Then on the smaller scale, you think of him walking with the disciples and correcting them. They think we should do this. He says, no, you're missing the point. Rebuked by Simon, and on it goes, like constant clash of agendas, perceptions. Yeah. And yet nobody would doubt when they read about Jesus that how much he loves them, loves us. But there's a lot of it's his program, not our program, his agenda, not our agenda, his ideas, not our ideas, pretty much constantly. And so in that sense, it's very consistent with what we run into in Job. And what you're doing is you're helping us to see there's also the intimacy factor that we think is novel, new in the New Testament, but it's not. It's very present in this very difficult book of Job.
Find any so-called theological emphasis in the New Testament, and it's drawing on lines of continuity from the Old Testament. These are not wholesale innovations. And I really like, Alan, your point about the sort of surprise of Jesus' messiahship. And I think that the connections between the gospel and the book of Job are many, and they're robust. And one of them is that I would say God answers ultimately not in the whirlwind, but in the womb. How does God ultimately answer an unfair world? He steps into it in the person of Jesus. And in a way that's both surprising and unsurprising, because Jesus was always apparently catching people off guard with the kind of kingdom he was bringing and the way that he was bringing it. And yet, after the road to Emmaus, Jesus' followers are looking back and going, oh, of course, it's been in the scriptures all along. You know, like, this is exactly what we've been waiting for. And yet, expectations still needed to be reframed when Jesus came to bring that kind of kingdom. And it's quite similar. It's quite analogous to what happens with God's answer in the book of Job.
And since you mentioned this, the road to Emmaus, interpreting the scriptures, but as you know, church history-wise, the way that's been done has actually undermined the version of God in the Old Testament sort of thing, in my opinion, not actually representing him well. So then you have to transform him where he's appearing a little bit too rough. And I think it's actually missing his strength in the New Covenant scriptures, where it is. And in fact, it's in Hebrews we read that our God's a consuming fire.
No, I'm read Revelation, read Hebrews.
Absolutely.
It definitely doesn't get softer.
So did you answer the question, though, the earlier one? Did anything throw you for a loop?
Yeah, so I suppose what I gave you were things that really kept me wrestling. I don't know that there was anything that made me feel momentarily that the whole thesis premise has been thwarted. But I'm trying to think of other I will say, so at Cambridge, there's a first year review process, which is not after a full calendar year, but after one academic year. And so around this time in my first year, you go in and two people have read this set of materials about your proposed direction for the project. And then they just, again, grill you with questions for a couple of hours. And mine was far more combative than I thought it would be. And they were asking really probing questions. And so they thankfully passed me and said, keep going. But that I came out of that meeting thinking, okay, I need to do a bit more work over the summer about my kind of basic methodological grounding. By methodology, I just mean the way I'm going to go about my method for my study of the text and the way that I'm going to situate myself in the scholarly conversation. Because you're supposed to be making some kind of contribution if you're doing a PhD, contribution to scholarship. So I think that was probably the period where I actually thought, okay, I need to back up here. And my initial idea for how I was actually going to write the thesis and construct the argument needs some reworking. Even though a lot of my ideas about how the Book of Job works were already there, at least in skeletal form, I was still going to need to do a lot more digging to put, that's going to be a mixed metaphor. I was going to say to put flesh on the bones, but I was going to need to do more research to put flesh on those bones. That's probably what stands out to me most. But then you realize you may have this kind of broad idea, but as you start drilling into any part of the text, there always is more to be pulling at. Things get more complicated. And then you do this sort of necessary but nauseating zooming in and out, because you always need to have big picture. Okay, now make sure it's faithful to the details. And then make sure your interpretation of the details coheres with the bigger picture. So that's, as I say, a necessary part of doing a PhD, but can feel a little bit taxing to be always zooming in and out.
So speaking of the details, there's so many of these speeches by Job's friends or so-called friends. I don't know if you have an opinion on that, but the speeches themselves. So people are doing their Bible reading, and today they're reading one of Job's friends. That's what, to get through the Bible in a year or whatever. Like, what are they for? Like, why can't we just have some sort of statement, Job's friends gave him a hard time, and summarize it? Why do we have to read and read and read these, what we might think are very misguided statements about God and Job?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Alan. One time I gave a talk that I entitled Dizzying Doom and Gloom, Why Not to Skip Job 3-37? Because I think that impression that you've described is a really widespread one. And I think it's so deliberate. So whenever someone says, I find the speeches of Job and his friends quite depressing and confusing, and I just don't like them, and they're really hard to get through, I'm like,
even Job's speeches. I was just dealing with the friends, but
sure. Okay. I mean, you've got the friends, but then you also have Job railing against God and saying some of the harshest things, probably the harshest things, even more than lament psalms about God, in the Hebrew Bible, and I suppose when you have Job and the friends in conjunction, and you're trying to figure out what the grounds of their disagreement is, if they're making any progress, why are they still talking? Do the friends have different viewpoints than each other? Are they saying anything new in the third round of speeches versus the first round? So you're trying to ask all of these evaluative questions. And critically, the narrator's evaluations have dropped out. So our narrator has always been pretty shy. You don't get a lot of just very clear proclamations from the narrator. But in the prologue of Job, the first two chapters, after Job speaks in response to his sufferings, both times, chapter 1 and chapter 2, the narrator chimes in and says, good job, Job. He spoke well. And so now, as soon as you hit chapter 3, the narrator's receded. And so that leaves you as the reader, having come out of the prologue, now, as I say, kind of sitting in the seat of judge, or at least you think you're supposed to be, and you're trying to evaluate this torrent of verbiage. And I think that sort of the overall intended effect, or one of the overall intended effects of persevering through this torrent of words from Job and his friends is actually to increase your sense of desperation and longing. We need God's voice to break into this impasse. Because Job's friends are characterized as, in my view, the best of the best of human answers. So I call them, sort of tongue-in-cheek, the tenured professors of the day. So these are witty old wise men from an Eastern tradition renowned for wisdom, and their poetry is in a really elevated literary style. So you get the sense that if anyone were to be able to answer Job on the basis of human wisdom, it ought to be these three. And yet you watch Job be unsatisfied by what they have to say, and you actually watch their dialogue devolve such that the third dialogue cycle is incomplete. Bildad has a tiny, he's a second friend, has a short speech, and then there's none for Zophar, the third friend. And so I think you've actually watched them run out of words. And Job has not reached resolution. He's not satisfied.
So I'm concerned that your years at Cambridge has affected you, and I think in your mind, you're picturing these three elderly professors sitting in one of those beautiful rooms with the fireplace and the pipe, pontificating about Job, using torrents of verbiage. Come on. I could just see you in ChatGPT. You're trying to create your image of Job's friends a la Cambridge professors.
Well, no, I don't mean to sort of import that. I guess I'm trying to sort of, for the modern audience, kind of recontextualize. Like, what would, for an ancient Israelite or even like a third century Jew reading the book of Job, how are they understanding the friends? Who are they seeing them to be in terms of their characterization? And I do think, yeah, in their being old, that's associated with respect, with prestige. They cite kind of the tradition of the former generations that's supposed to be credible. They're from the East, which in various other parts of the Hebrew Bible is associated with a wisdom tradition. And it is just the case that people often remark on their literary style, that it does seem like this elevated register of speech is really witty, the way that they talk. And they have a really diverse vocabulary. And so, okay. Yeah,
I love the way you said, no, you haven't done that, but you're explaining to me why that's exactly what you're picturing. It's
well, but I think it's a useful.
It's not a criticism. I think it's great. And I think it's really helpful because I think for a lot of modern readers reading in English, we don't get the right picture. And we think of things, people call them Job's friends. So it sounds like his buddies heard he's sick. They're coming by. But actually, yeah, these are, these should be, they are the philosophical experts of the day, the biblical scholars of the day. They're the ones that are supposed to be able to size up the situation and give the accurate analysis so that Job and the reader is fully and properly informed.
And they give the conventional answer, like they give the sort of thing you'd expect, but you just know as the
reader.
Well,
until the guy,
wrong.
Whoever it says that whole thing of like you, not only have you sinned, but you like that's you should be suffering worse for all that you've done, even though we don't know what it is. But that's so human.
Yeah, and they become sort of increasingly absurd. So they start off sounding a bit more gentle. But by Eliphaz's last speech, he is accusing Job of blatant injustice that you just know Job has not done and will be completely counter to the way that Job presents his record of innocence in chapter 31 in terms of his care for the orphan and the widow and his generosity towards the people who work for him and all of these.
What do we say to the person that expects to you know, when they read the Bible, they're hoping to warm their heart, to encourage them for the day, and they have to read
when you open up to Job.
Part of Job today. What do we say to them? How do we help them?
Yeah, it's a really good and pastoral question. And my gentle challenge and encouragement would be to ask this hypothetical individual, who I think actually represents a lot of people, to examine their paradigm, their framework for what the Bible is. So if you think that the Bible is a collection of ethical tidbits or inspirational sayings, then yes, you could expect to flick it open and over your cup of coffee, grab something for your back pocket in the day and move on. However, if that's not the kind of text that the Bible is, that doesn't mean it doesn't have substantive wisdom, to use that word again. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have things that are relevant, that are fresh, that are comforting, that are also challenging. It doesn't mean that all those things aren't true, but actually it often means it's going to take a lot more work. I think it's been really useful for me across my engagement with the scriptures, Job or otherwise, to have the image of wrestling in my mind and to think, actually, this is an enterprise for a lifetime in the context of community. And it's way harder than I initially thought and way more glorious than I initially thought. And this is meant to be meditated on over and over and over. You're meant to ask questions and then have the scriptures challenge the questions you're asking and then have a community of believers open your eyes to insights that you wouldn't have noticed otherwise. And this very act of wrestling is formative for us as the people of God. And I think helps to cultivate in us a right kind of curiosity and humility in our relating with God and with one another as we are ready to engage the scriptures in that way. So it may be that, yeah, if you're reading through the Bible in the year, you're finding the middle part of Job really hard to get through. And I'd say, well done, keep going. Finish the book and actually don't skip to the end because you're missing something. The ending won't hit in the same way if you skipped the middle. And for me, I just, to be honest, when I started Job, I did not like the book. I had no idea what it was doing and was completely intimidated by it. I thought, what have I done signing myself up for 3 years in Job? So I have like a conversion story of Job and enthusiasm. Where I just thought, you know what, that just means I'm ignorant, not that the book of Job is deficient in some way. So why don't I instead adopt the posture of a curious student and just ask God to teach me and get ready to wrestle and have that feel costly in some ways, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it seems
anyway,
that,
that's a lot.
Yeah, so words, but. The people who are still reading a paper Bible, we think of the Bible as this book, you know, it's God's mm-hmm. book. But it's a collection of books. Some of the books are themselves, you know, like Psalms, Proverbs are collections. Mm. Other parts are true books in and of themselves, but we don't treat them that way. And your experience of Job has shown the way to understand Job is to wrestle with it as a book. Mm. It's a complete mm-hmm. book. It's not something that could be chopped up. You know, even the way that, hundreds of years ago, they separated things by chapters with numbers and verses mm. with numbers. That's artificial. Yeah. I don't know if everyone realizes that, but it's artificial imposed on the text, where both in Greek and Hebrew, there weren't even spaces in the words, like they're between the words. And they're complete works. And we would do better to treat them that right now. I'm personally working through the book of Acts, and I'm sure this is true with other biblical books, but Luke's writing as an author of this book is phenomenal in the way that he anticipates, the way that he summarizes things you find in a book are present in many of the biblical books. So, you know, if you, when somebody told you there's this amazing, like, spiritual, philosophical book in an ancient setting, you got to read it, it's going to blow your mind, you don't start reading page by page, paragraph by paragraph, line by line, chapter by chapter, thinking you're going to get something out of that. Mm. You're going to wait to the end to appreciate the book, but that doesn't mean there isn't something in the details themselves. Mm. So, having said that, are there things in the details themselves? Like does it matter, or is it only the details as part of the bigger picture of the book?
I would say, maybe this goes back to my sort of zooming in and out. We do need to be paying attention to both. So I think for the the Bible reader sitting in the pew on Sunday, they would do well sometimes to be reading very slowly and carefully and really mulling on the details. And then it's also great if you just plow through a lot of text in one sitting and have this very different vantage point. Doing both of those things is really good and really important. And they will be mutually reinforcing. They'll affect each other. And you also need to be doing that not just in the book level, but also on the canonical level. So read through, you know, as quickly as you can the entire Torah, for instance. And that will be instructive in a way that crawling through Genesis, yeah, it will be different. And you may miss some of the details when you're flying so high and so fast, but that's okay. You can do both kinds of reading. I think also probably our sort of conventional Protestant paradigm for preaching, where you take basically a paragraph of text and you move through it, also maybe conditions people sometimes to think that that is the best way or even the only way to engage with reading the Bible. You pretty much have to take a paragraph and just sit in it. It's a lot less common, at least in many Protestant churches, to preach through a chunk of text. But actually, I think for a book like Job, if that were to be a series, it would be much better to take it in chunks rather than in paragraphs, because I just think that's a much more fruitful way to read along the grain of the text. One of the things you're trying to do is ask the questions of the text after it, read along the grain of the text. And so sometimes it's a bit artificial, as you're saying, to kind of impose these particular organizational or breakdown strategies on the book that...
Yeah. In terms of preaching, whether it's paragraphs or chunks, I just wish more preaching was directly out of the text and not topics read onto scripture and picking and choosing to things to fit what the points that people are trying to make. But your point is still well taken, that those who are exposed to focusing on a paragraph might think that's the only way to look at the Bible. And again, the big picture details together, which is really how we interact with most art forms. Whether it's look at a painting, you stand back, you look at the whole picture, you begin to focus on, then you start seeing the little details, then you go back again, and now you're seeing the big picture differently, which then helps you see the details better. And I think we could be doing that with scripture more. So speaking of that, has your Job study affected how you view the Bible in general? You may have alluded to this already, but has it changed at all?
How I view the Bible in general? I think, I do think of Job now as kind of a microcosm, a miniaturized version of the whole biblical story in some way. And so that's been...
Are you sure that's not because you're suffering from some sort of Jobitis after being in it for so long?
Where you just see Job everywhere.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Well, I think, Alan, I think I'm reading Job in that sense like James is. So I feel a little bit better if I'm in league with James. As in, I think James 5 likens the ending of Job, the epilogue of Job, and when Job is restored, to the second coming of Jesus. And so I think actually... A, that makes sense that he's reading the book in that way for a host of reasons that I won't get into now. And I think also then theologically you can look back and think, oh yeah, actually the story starts well and you have an ending that's more than the beginning, but it still resembles the beginning. And you have in the scriptures a garden scene in Revelation that looks an awful lot like where we started in the garden, which we didn't even think could get better than it was when we started in Genesis. And yet we've ended somewhere more than we started. And critical
by the way,
development is...
If I could just interrupt you for a second. So that idea that Eden is is perfection that we need to go back to, which is very popular. I don't believe that's the biblical idea.
Yeah.
That with or without the human rebellion sin, I think we would have gone on to something greater. And that's why what we do have is we start with the garden and end with a city at the end, that there was always going to be a development. So I'm agreeing with you, actually.
Yes. No, I agree with you too. And it is this sort of Guardian City at the end. So you have some of these Edenic elements, but everything is, like in the Book of Job, more than where we started. It's not just a return to exactly the starting point. So I suppose that is one way of reading Job in conjunction with the rest of the scriptures that I hadn't thought about or seen before beginning. But I just remember my first academic year when we hit Holy Week in the liturgical calendar. And I just had my imagination thoroughly steeped in Job. And so inevitably, I'm going to be asking Job and Jesus, how do these things fit together? And I wasn't content to just sit with the conventional connection to Job 19. I know my Redeemer lives. I was like, okay, I think, A, I want to read that passage carefully in terms of what it's meaning to convey within the book. And also, I think there's probably more going on in terms of how Job and the gospel relate. So I think that in terms of just a connection has felt new. Has it approached how I read the Bible? I think this sort of relates to both how I read the Bible, but also critically just how I live life. The book of Job has made me so much more aware in my bones of something that I would have always doctrinally affirmed, which is the creator-creature distinction. So this point I was making before about God is God and I am not. God is not like me, that there's a fundamental difference between the creator and his creatures. This is one of the most basic affirmations of biblical faith and is, again, something I always would have affirmed. But I just see it everywhere around me now. Like if I track in a given day what makes me restless, 9 times out of 10 or more, it's because I've hit one of my creaturely limits, either of knowledge or of power or both. So things I don't understand or things I can't control, and I'm resenting those limits and wishing I could surpass them. That makes me restless, right? And again and again, I'm met with this invitation from Job. Are you willing to trust God's wisdom? Yes, you will remain within these creaturely limits. God is not going to take them away. But how do you live well within those creaturely limits and run in the wisdom lane that God has given to you, which looks like fear God and turn away from evil? I do have a real participation in his wisdom. But that doesn't mean that, yeah, my limits disappear. And so why should I be restless as if they ought to? And so I've been much more attuned to that now as I read other parts of the scriptures and just in my daily discipleship. So I think that's been, yeah, kind of a deep structure, long-term work of the book of Job on me.
No, I think something profound that you've alluded to is there you've spent these years so soaked in the book of Job and discovered how much it's like the rest of the Bible. And that it actually, this book that a lot of people would rather skip over and think it's like, it's very other. What's it doing here?
Outlier.
An outlier. That's right. And yet, if you really get into it, you see that it's in keeping with the rest of scripture while contributing something unique to the overall story of God.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And I think that's a real encouragement for people to stick with Job, to look forward to your popular version of your dissertation one day, which hopefully will be sooner than later. But with or without that, you know, the Bible is accessible, but you do need to take the time to think about what we need to take the time to think about what we're reading. And we often assume that because God has made himself accessible to us, the journey's going to be easy. But God doesn't want it to be easy for us. And books like Job and other parts of the Bible that require wrestling, that's part of what we need in our growth as human beings. And it's a real gift from God. So on behalf of everyone, I want to thank you for giving your life for the past few years in this endeavor and being open to how the Lord has been wanting to teach you and how he's blessed you. And we look forward to seeing how he's going to use you and your husband-to-be in the days and years ahead.
Yes, thank you so much.
We talked earlier about how people can contact you, and the answer to that question is because Ellie's going through a move and changes to her life and everything. If you have a question for her, you can contact me and I will forward on to her. But are you going to continue doing things like a newsletter, a blog, or anything like that?
Yeah, I am planning to keep the Substack that I've been writing in monthly. I am planning, at least for the time being, to keep that up and running. So that shouldn't stop when Cambridge ends.
How can people find that?
Oh, yes. Well, one way would probably be to Google Ellie Wiener Cambridge or Ellie Wiener Job, and it may come up. But more directly, I will just give you the link for the Substack, and you could put that in the description if you want.
Okay, so we're going to have a link in the description to your Substack. For people who don't know, Substack is almost like a blog for journalists and academics. It's just a little more serious. It's almost like a social media platform, but serious articles and things. And it tends to be a free versus paid tier for people to join. Do you have a free and paid? Do you do that?
Well, I do have free and paid, except there's actually no difference in what people see. So I don't want to make people pay, but if anyone out of the kindness and generosity of their heart wants to support my writing, then I will accept it.
So folks,
so that's how I've handled it.
Ellie's finishing up her PhD studies. She has a big move ahead. She's getting married. And so there you go. If you want to bless her, you could sign on to her Substack and join the paid tier. So then people can contact you via the Substack, right?
Actually, that's true as well.
Yeah, so that'll work. You could reply to a post. However you want to do it, either you can contact me and I'll send on your question, comment to Ellie, or you can contact her through her Substack. Is there anything else you want to share to tie this chapter up before we go?
Just thanks be to God, really. I remember just spending some time in prayer before I had my thesis defense last week. And I just was so conscious that I didn't want to walk into that room resting in confidence that was grounded in myself, whatever I've achieved or understood, and just wanted to be reminded again of how generously the Lord has taught me. And so, yeah, I really just, not that I've sorted out the book of Job, but I'm just so thankful for the Lord's faithfulness in teaching each step of the way. So, yeah, praise God.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm so appreciate that you've been willing to come on. Also, take me on this journey through your experience with Job, and want to remind everyone that you can access those first two segments, and you'll get to see how Ellie has what she's gone through in this. And I think there's a lot of information in those previous podcasts that you'll find helpful. So again, thank you, Ellie, so much, and God bless you as you get married soon and start in a new household, a new life, new work. And may God bless you overwhelmingly so.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome. Hopefully we'll find another subject to talk about in the future.
That's right. That's right. I'll still be studying the Bible, so there'll be got to be something. Great.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, I hope you were blessed by that as much as I was. Remember, you can contact Ellie either by contacting me. You can email me at comments@thinkingbiblically.org about anything about this podcast, other issues that you want to bring up, guests that you might want to suggest. But if you want to contact Ellie, you could do so by contacting me, or you can go to her Substack, as she mentioned, and all that information will be in the description, as well as the links to the previous conversations I had with Ellie. And so again, to contact me, do so at comments@thinkingbiblically.org. And so until next time, this is Alan Gilman with Thinking Biblically.